And all of this is aimed at, I think, eventually presenting a fait accompli to the Southeast Asian parties, such that they'll just have to accept whatever deal China's still putting on the table. And, you know, the Americans and the Australians and the Japanese and the French and the British, we might sail through every once in a while and honk the horn and say we're doing a FONOP, but that's not going to do Southeast Asian parties any good. FONOPs can't help Filipino fishermen.
At the end of March, more than 200 Chinese fishing vessels were spotted anchored off of Whitsun Reef, a contested land feature in the South China Sea. These were no normal fishing vessels, however. They were part of China's maritime militia, a paramilitary fleet used to establish China's control over hotly contested waters with an air of deniability. The amassing of the vessels around the reef has set off warning bells in the Philippines, Vietnam, and the United States alike, as similar incidents in the past have led to China's de facto control over strategically important features within the sea. In today's podcast, we discuss the complex maritime and territorial disputes of the South China Sea, the sea's importance to regional and global powers, and what may come of the current standoff at Whitsun. Joining us today to discuss is Greg Poling.
Greg Poling is a senior fellow for Southeast Asia and director of the Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative at CSIS. He oversees research on U.S. foreign policy in the Asia Pacific, with a particular focus on the maritime domain and the countries of Southeast Asia.
All right, Mr. Poling, thank you so much for coming today on the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So to get us started, the dispute in the South China Sea is incredibly complex, to say the least. Before we kind of jump into Whitsun Reef, would you give our listeners a crash course on the South China Sea itself? What are its main physical features? And more generally, why is the sea seen as so important to both neighboring countries and far-off powers like the United States?
Yeah, so when we talk about the South China Sea, I think it's useful to remind everybody that we're really talking about two different sets of disputes. So there's the territorial dispute over multiple island groups, and we're using the term island very loosely, the Spratly Islands in the south, the Paracel Islands, which are disputed by Vietnam and China in the northwest, and then the smaller Scarborough Shoal, which is contested by China and the Philippines off the coast of Luzon. There's also Pratas Reef, which is claimed only by China and Taiwan. All of those territorial disputes are issues among the claimants, but really don't involve the outside parties. For decades, going back to before World War II, the position of most of the international community, including the U.S., has been overt neutrality on who has a stronger historic claim to those rocks and reefs, as long as nobody uses force. And that latter is particularly important to the U.S. because we have a mutual defense treaty with the Philippines and could potentially be called into any conflict that arises. Then you have a second dispute over waters, airspace, and seabed. So this is the maritime dispute over the rules of the road in the South China Sea and what kind of maritime claims to resources and law enforcement rights and the like parties are entitled to make. All of the Southeast Asian claimants make their maritime claims within the context of the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. So they claim territorial seas, exclusive economic zones, continental shelves, and so on from their coastlines or from the islands in those disputed groups that they claim. The problem really becomes China's claim, usually demarcated through what's called the nine-dash line, to vast and ill-defined historic rights throughout the entire South China Sea, with really no regard for what UNCLOS or the customary international law that underpins it says about the matter. That's a big problem for the international community. So when the Americans and the Japanese and the Australians and now the Europeans complain about the South China Sea, mostly what they're complaining about is this idea that China has decided that rules don't apply to Beijing's claims in the South China Sea. And from Washington's perspective, that's a threat to the entire regime of maritime law, which U.S. governments have been committed to upholding going all the way back to Jefferson sending the Marines against the Barbary pirates.
That makes a lot of sense, Greg. One thing I want to dig into is the maritime and territorial disputes that you just talked about, the most important of which is, most important subjectively, maybe most consequential, is China's nine-dash line. Why, what is the reasoning for China claiming such a vast territory or maritime area in the South China Sea? Why is this important to China?
The Nine Dash Line is a really interesting case study in how nationalist politics can rewrite the history of a thing. So the Nine Dash Line originally comes out of an effort by the nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek, started in 1929, to establish what the borders of a new unified China should be. And as part of that, he called together a group of cartographers who pored over, among other things, British sailing charts and tried to decide exactly what the limits of the Qing Empire had been, which had never been very well defined before. And one of the things that they did, particularly a guy named Bai Meichu, is take a bunch of those British sailing charts, look at all of these scattered islands that the Brits had identified in the South China Sea, and give them a bunch of Chinese names. So you have the majority of the islands in the South China Sea still are Chinese transliterations of old British sailing ships that first saw them. That was, I suppose, fine, because other than the French and in the parallels the Vietnamese, nobody else was really contesting those claims. And as shorthand, a couple years later, Bai Meichu slaps a 9-dash line, well, at the time an 11-dash line, around those islands, and says, I don't really know if I got them all. I have no idea how many islands are out there. No Chinese official has ever been to them, but we're going to claim all of these, everything within the line. That was fine. That line gets accepted after World War II. It then gets picked up by the PRC. But over the succeeding decades, the line transitioned from being just a claim to the islands within it to taking on this odd life of its own, being a claim to waters and seabed and airspace and all kinds of historic rights, so that by 1998, for the first time, Beijing bakes this idea of historic rights within the Nine Dash Line into official legislation, into the national law on the exclusive economic zone. That's also when suddenly the Americans get very worried, because prior to the 90s, the Nine Dash Line and China's claims were a regional sideshow to be managed. As long as nobody got into a fight over it, then the rest of the world didn't care. But now, all of a sudden, China's declaring that these odd historic dashes are a national boundary of sorts that extend 1,000 miles from the Chinese coast. And that's something that the U.S. and the international community couldn't live with.
Mm. Yes, I find the history of the Nine Dash Line also really fascinating. One last thing, and then I think we'll move on to the next section. You touched on this a little bit about claims to seabeds and resources. Could you talk a little bit about the kind of speculation of oil and gas resources in the South China Sea and talk about maybe whether or not that is a big component of why this area is so contested?
The actual hydrocarbon resources are probably a lot smaller than people think, particularly people who might, you know, read news articles that use this as a lead. Oh, the South China Sea with its vast untapped oil and gas resources. The vast majority of oil and gas that's been discovered in the South China Sea and that most people think is commercially exploitable is actually around the edges, the shallower parts of the sea just off the coasts of China in the north, some off the middle coast of Vietnam, a lot off Malaysia, and some in the waters north of Indonesia's Natuna Islands. Around the islands themselves that are contested, the Spratlys and the Paracels, there's basically nothing of commercial value. The only things that have been commercially tapped within disputed waters of the Nine Dash Line are a couple of places like Vanguard Bank off Vietnam, which is not considered part of the Spratlys by anybody outside of Beijing. It's this entire underwater piece of the seabed. But I will say that the speculation and the hunt for hydrocarbons has in years past had an accelerating effect on the dispute. So from 1968 through the mid 70s, the rush to occupation by Vietnam and the Philippines was driven at least in part by speculation about oil and gas around the Spratlys. That was probably also a factor in Malaysia's move to begin occupying the Spratlys in the 80s. That's all kind of turned out to be a bust, though. And so in 2021, oil and gas is, you know, important, but it's not the thing driving the South China Sea disputes.
I think that's a really important point, Greg. Thank you for clarifying that for us. And before I pass it off to Franz here, the last thing I want maybe some clarification on before we dive into it is the 2016 International Tribunal Law of the Seas ruling. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about the importance of that ruling and maybe how the world has responded to that?
Sure. So the, you know, the current cycle of escalation that we find ourselves in the South China Sea dates back more than a decade now, really to 2009, when Malaysian Vietnam submitted claims to what's called the Extended Continental Shelf under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, beyond 200 nautical miles from the South China Sea, under a UN deadline. And China responded by, for the first time, submitting the nine-dash line as an official claim of its historic rights. And after that, things steadily spiraled. The next big shoe to drop was Scarborough Shoal in 2012, when Filipino naval vessels tried to interdict Chinese fishing ships poaching for endangered species at Scarborough Shoal, and it provoked this months-long standoff, which is a whole other story. But when China refused to vacate the shoal after that standoff and effectively occupied it without building anything, they remain in control of it now, 9 years later, the then government of Benigno Aquino in the Philippines responded in 2013 by filing this landmark arbitration case, feeling that they had no other choice as the smaller, weaker party here. It was the first time that a case of this scale had been filed under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea. And UNCLOS, as it's called, is really unique in that it has a very clear and very straightforward, in a sense, binding arbitration process. So the vast majority of treaties don't have compulsory dispute settlement. Both parties have to agree. UNCLOS, it was decided, would have compulsory dispute settlement. And that's because it was so complex and far-reaching that all the parties, China included, who were there in the 1970s and 80s, decided that if they allowed states to carve out large sections of the treaty from which they couldn't be brought to dispute settlement, it would end up undermining the entire thing. So that's my long way of saying China was totally on board with compulsory dispute settlement mechanisms under UNCLOS when it helped negotiate and ratify UNCLOS. It wasn't until it actually faced a case that China decided that it wanted to oppose that ruling. So anyway, China refuses to take part, as great powers often do. The case moved forward anyway. Finally came down in July 2016, and the Filipinos won a resounding victory. I mean, they brought 15 claims against China, and they won 14 of them. And the other one, the court just found it didn't have jurisdiction. The biggest components of the ruling, first, the court ruled that the nine-dash line has no relevancy in modern international law. It is a meaningless claim if it is a claim to anything other than islands themselves. Second, the court ruled that none of the features within the Spratly Islands, so none of these dry rocks or small islets, qualify for their own exclusive economic zone or continental shelf. These are the 200-mile zones in which a state gets exclusive fishing and resource rights. And that's because they are too small to sustain human habitation themselves, which is the requirement for a fully entitled island under the treaty. There were other issues. It ruled that several of the features China occupies or claims are in fact not islands at all because they're entirely underwater at high tide, and therefore they belong either to the Philippines, in some cases as the closest coastal state, or they're just part of international waters. It also ruled that China had illegally destroyed the marine environment with its land reclamation and its illegal clam drilling, harvesting, that it had harassed illegally Philippine fishing and oil and gas rights and so on. Just, I mean, kind of knocked it out of the park for Manila.
Now, Greg, we want to move from the history of the dispute now to what's currently happening in the area. And although there have been many players in the dispute, as we have talked about already, China's actions in the region have sparked the most concern over the last decade. And now, to break up this big topic, would you start by describing to our listeners China's island building and outpost militarization activities since 2013 and why they're doing so?
Sure. So if we follow that chain of events that I started from 2012, Future Scarborough, and then the Philippines responds in early 2013 by filing the arbitration case, that filing of the arbitration case seems to have convinced Xi Jinping and his government that it was time to launch this massive island reclamation and militarization campaign, which had been on, it had been mooted for quite a while. We now know that Chinese officials, military officials had been lobbying for this. Chinese SOEs had put in bids for it. The Hu Jintao government had always considered the idea of massively expanding China's islands to be too provocative. Xi is, let's say, a much more forward-leaning and nationalist leader than Hu was. And presumably the Philippines' refusal to bend to China's will convinced Beijing to finally launch this campaign. So in December 2013, a fleet of huge dredging ships, what are called suction cutter dredgers. These are boats that have a hose on one end and a hard pipe on the other. The hard pipe gets crammed down onto the coral in the seabed, crushes it all up, and then spits out the sand from the hose on the other end. They show up at Fiery Cross Reef, one of China's islands, actually the first that it occupied back in 1988. And they start dredging land. And then they go to three more. And then when nobody stops them, eventually over the course of 2014, they go to three more. So by the end of 2014, there's dredging work and landfill work going on at all seven of China's island bases, all seven of the features that it occupied since 1988. If you fast forward to the time that the ruling came out in 2016, by that point, the island dredging and reclamation work was basically done. China had, in the course of just over 2 years, created 3,200 acres of land that didn't exist before. It also added another few hundred up in the Paracels, expanding islands there, which doesn't get reported on as much. On those 3,200 acres of new land in the Spratlys, China built three large air and naval bases. So these are at Fiery Cross Reef, I mentioned, at Subi Reef, which is the closest to the major Philippine-held island in the Spratlys called Ditu Island, and at Mischief Reef, which is this huge, previously entirely underwater reef, pretty close to the Philippines. To give you a sense of scale, Mischief Reef is large enough that you could fit most of Washington, D.C. inside the 495 Beltway into the lagoon in the middle of it. Subi Reef is large enough that you could fit Pearl Harbor Naval Base into its lagoon. So these are pretty massive facilities. And then the other four turned into small listening posts. Once the island building was done, China moved into this militarization phase where it was building hard infrastructure on the islands. 3,000-meter airstrips went down on what we call the Big Three, Fiery Cross, Subi, and Mischief. 72 fighter jet hangars in total go up alongside those airstrips, along with a dozen more for transport aircraft and patrol aircraft and bombers. You have underground fuel and storage capacity that's built. You have hardened shelters for anti-ship cruise missiles and anti-air missiles, point defenses all around it. And of course, just tons of sensing and communications infrastructure. So at this point, one must assume that China, uniquely among all the other claimants, sees everything that moves on above and a lot of what moves under the South China Sea. And all of that infrastructure buildup was basically done by end of 2017, early 2018. So for the last 3 years, we've been in the use phase. Now you have China doing what these islands were presumably always intended to do, which is act as forward operating bases for Chinese Coast Guard, Navy, some air, and a huge fleet of militia actors.
And along those lines, Greg, China's maritime militia made news last week, and it was reported all over, you know, the New York Times, Foreign Policy. What exactly is this tool of Chinese hard power? And also, how have other claimant states and the United States responded to not only this buildup, but also just China's militarization of the region?
When we talk about a Chinese maritime militia, it's important to be clear that we're not, you know, talking about, we're not using artistic license here. The maritime militia is a formal component of China's power projection capabilities in the South China Sea. China's military service law dating back to the 80s requires all young men who leave military service to sign up for the militia. Most of them do that as weekend warriors back in their hometown. But if your hometown's a fishing village, then you did it on a fishing boat. And that's what they were for most of say, the 70s, 80s, 90s, fishermen who would occasionally do military service on the weekends. since the late aughts, and certainly over the last 10 years, we've seen a professionalization of this official militia force, at least some component of it. So you have a handful of kind of banner militia units operating in a couple of villages along the coast of Hainan and in Guangdong in particular, as well as on Sansha, which is the main Chinese base in the Paracels. These are pretty well heeled. Their boats are quite new, quite large. They're funded by the Chinese government. They get paid to do things like run supplies out to China's islands, to serve as communications and surveillance assets for China. So every one of these boats gets a free Beidou transceiver, which is China's equivalent of GPS, which allows two-way communication with the China Coast Guard. They go out and just kind of keep an eye on things. And occasionally, when there's some big blow-up, say over a fishing standoff or an oil and gas standoff with Vietnam or the Philippines, and you suddenly see 100 Chinese fishing boats on the scene, that's who they're calling up. It's these semi-professionalized militia. As the big harbors in the Spratlys, particularly the two at Subi and Mischief that I mentioned, which are the biggest, as those became complete and operational in late 2017, early 2018, the number of these militia boats forward deployed in the Spratlys exploded. So by late 2018, there were on the order of 300 fishing boats operating daily, fishing militia operating daily at Subi and Mischief. And you know they're militia because they never fish. If these were commercial fishermen, they would all be bankrupt. They tie up next to each other and ride at anchor sometimes for weeks at a time until suddenly they get called up and you see them drop anchor off a Philippine island and sit for weeks at a time, or show up to escort Chinese marine surveys off Malaysia, things like that. If they are fishing, they're doing it as a hobby, not as a career. This has been a huge problem for the regional claimants, as well as outside parties like the U.S. One, it presents a huge escalatory problem for the other states, because the point of the militia is its deniability, its pseudo-civilian nature. If you respond to it with Coast Guard or Naval Force, Beijing will point at you and say, you've just militarized this dispute. Two, it makes the math pretty brutal. If China's got 300 fishing militia that serve as military auxiliaries, and you're the Philippine Coast Guard, how are you supposed to keep up with that? I mean, you've probably only got a dozen boats, fewer than that maybe, that actually has the endurance to operate in the Spratlys. You can't possibly chase every Chinese fishing boat on the off chance it's a militia boat. And for the U.S., there's huge problems with rules of engagement. We've had multiple incidents over the last 10 years or so in which militia boats have been at the forefront of harassing U.S. Navy ships transiting the South China Sea. The U.S. Navy does not have a clear set of rules of engagement for what you do if a civilian boat intentionally rams you or cuts across your bow, or as they did in 2009, starts dropping flotsam off the front to try to get in your way. And so if you approach the South China Sea with a military first policy, which the U.S. basically has for the last 10 years, you're at a huge disadvantage.
So now that we've kind of accumulated some background on the disputes and China's actions in the South China Sea, let's sort of dive into the current situation at Whitsun Reef. What exactly is going on there?
So I mentioned that since 2018, there have been about 300 militia boats operating in the Spratlys on any given day. That still seems to be the case. Early this year, suddenly 200 of those 300 were parked at this reef called Whitsun Reef, which the Philippines calls Julian Felipe Reef, China calls Niuajiao. This is part of a bigger reef structure in the Spratlys called Union Banks. The Spratlys is really made up of four main reef groups. And what we call the islands and reefs are actually just the parts of those bigger reefs that are closest to the surface. So Whitsun Reef is at one end of this bigger structure called Union Banks. Union Banks also contains two of China's bases, its smaller bases, Johnson and Hughes Reefs, and it contains four Vietnamese bases. It looks like what China has tried to do is establish Whitsun Reef as a permanent anchorage for these militia vessels, because there's really not a lot of room for them to park at the two small Chinese bases on Union Banks. So think of Whitsun as a parking lot. It's being used to hold large numbers of Chinese vessels whose goal apparently is to control the water and access to this larger structure, Union Banks. So in that sense, it seems like this deployment is actually more targeted at the Vietnamese and the Filipinos, but all of Union Banks, including Whitsun Reef, sits closer to the Philippines than it does to Vietnam, much closer than it does to China. So it is technically within the Philippine exclusive economic zone. And the Filipinos are the ones who, upon discovering that there were 200 militia boats riding at anchor for the last couple of months at Whitsun Reef, decided to go public with it, which is what's provoked this current standoff. You've had the Philippines demand to know what these boats are doing there, the Chinese embassy and then the Ministry of Foreign Affairs claiming rather disingenuously that they're just fishermen who are sheltering from a storm that apparently has gone on for 2 months and that nobody can see except for China. Certainly not the Philippine Coast Guard, who's sailed out in clear weather to take photos of them. And, you know, the now the kind of diplomatic war of words has taken on a momentum of its own, where I think the Philippines quite rightly is gobsmacked by these denials by Beijing. There was a moment where Senator Risa Ontiveros of the Philippines said, it's frustrating that China pretends that we're all hallucinating and can't see what we're actually seeing.
So we've kind of discussed the response from the Philippines, but what has been the response from the United States about this situation?
Mostly diplomatic signaling that the U.S. is backing the Philippines. You know, it's not clear what, if anything, the U.S. could or should do directly to try to intervene here. Nobody wants the Seventh Fleet to go in and drive off a bunch of, quote, civilian, you know, lightly armed militia vessels. And so mostly the U.S. is backing the Philippine diplomatic effort to name and shame these actors. The Philippines, as I said, has sent out two patrols to take pictures of these boats, get their hull numbers, publish them in the international press, and try to impose some reputational cost on Beijing in the hopes that if the rest of the world sees China acting like, you know, a mob boss in the South China Sea, it'll impose cost on Beijing's larger global equities. The other big thing the U.S. has done most recently yesterday with Ned Price, the State Department spokesman, is make very clear again and again that the U.S.-Philippine Mutual Defense Treaty does apply in the waters of the South China Sea. And that should a Philippine vessel or aircraft or any Philippine personnel come under attack, it will trigger U.S. mutual defense obligations under the NDT. And the point of that is you know, the U.S. is not going to, as I said, ride in and scatter these boats. But if at any point China decides to use force against these Philippine patrols, that would be a red line.
So what do you think China's real intentions are in this current standoff? And what do you think might come next?
Beijing's long-term goal has been the same for at least the last 25 years, which is control of all of the water, seabed, and airspace of the South China Sea, the so-called historic rights that Beijing has been claiming, which means that China is seemingly okay, at least for the time being, with the Philippines and Vietnam and Malaysia holding on to the small outposts that they have in the Spratlys, so long as China can establish control of all the waters around them, right? Beijing wants to make sure that nobody fishes and nobody drills for oil and gas, and certainly nobody conducts military exercises or surveillance anywhere in the South China Sea, except as China allows. And so a huge component of that has become this constant presence, this kind of, you know, constant steady state coercion by the militia and the China Coast Guard, which is just making life so difficult for Filipino and Vietnamese and Malaysian operators that they are slowly being squeezed out of the South China Sea. Fisheries are close to collapse. A lot of fishermen have had to give up the livelihood altogether. Vietnam's offshore energy industry is on the verge of collapse because nobody's willing to take the risk of drilling when they know they're going to get harassed by the China Coast Guard. The Malaysians have been facing constant harassment. And all of this is aimed at, I think, eventually presenting a fait accompli to the Southeast Asian parties such that they'll just have to accept whatever deal China's still putting on the table. And, you know, the Americans and the Australians and the Japanese and the French and the British, we might sail through every once in a while and honk the horn and say we're doing a FONOP, but that's not going to do Southeast Asian parties any good. FONOPs can't help Filipino fishermen. And so there's a huge mismatch, as I said, between the U.S. and really the whole international community's kind of military approach to the South China Sea and the paramilitary strategy that China's employing to get its way.
Greg, I want to follow up on that because I think it's a fascinating point, especially the point about the fait accompli. So from when you talked about the parking lot, it made me think of an analogy. Here in D.C., if I were to put my car in someone else's driveway, their parking spot, very highly coveted here in D.C., the government of D.C. would come and tow my car away. And if that doesn't happen, maybe the owner would push my car into the street. But in the South China Sea, when China's maritime militia goes and parks their militia, you know, wherever, maybe at Whitsun Reef, there is no one there to tow those ships away, and the Philippines doesn't have the power to do it itself. My question is, if the United States doesn't take an opinion on these territorial issues and thus, as you said, doesn't have or is only taking a military stance, is not taking a paramilitary stance to defend against these actions, how do we stop this fait accompli? How do we prevent the maritime militia from parking everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. has been clear and increasingly clear over the last few years that it doesn't take a position of neutrality in the South China Sea. It takes a position of, it does not take a stance on questions of territorial sovereignty. It does take a very clear stance on questions of maritime rights, right? So the U.S. isn't going to weigh in on who owns which rock. It will weigh in on what rules are supposed to be used to resolve maritime disputes. That increasingly is also the stated position of a lot of other outside parties. Last year, you had the British, the French, the Germans, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Japan, all having weighed in, India to a degree. And what that gets at is the point that international law is only as good as the normative pressure that countries feel to abide by it, right? There is no international police force that will kick in Xi Jinping's door and force compliance with the 2016 arbitration or with any international law. In a system of sovereign states, unless somebody's willing to, you know, go to war over it, really what holds everybody to the rules is the opportunity costs that come with breaking them. Right. So if, and of course, you can always get away with breaking a rule if your national interests override whatever the cost is. But at some point, if you are a serial rule breaker, you become a rogue, right? You become a pariah in the system, and that has huge opportunity costs. So for a rising great power, China wants clearly a seat at the table when it comes to new global rulemaking in the 21st century. And the only way that it will be compelled to follow the existing rules is if breaking those rules imposes so much reputational damage on Beijing that it undermines its ability to be a global rule setter in future. That makes it apparent that probably the best thing to happen to China's South China Sea claims in the last several years was Rodrigo Duterte's election as president of the Philippines in June 2016, because he took office on July 1st, 2016. I'm sorry, he was elected in May. Took office just 12 days before this arbitral ruling came out. Had the arbitral ruling come out 2 weeks earlier, we might be living in a very different world, because there would have been a couple days for the previous Philippine government to launch an international PR campaign to impose that kind of cost on China. Instead, the ruling got shoved into a drawer in Manila for several years, and China escaped largely scot-free as far as reputational cost. Now there is an effort underway, presumably by the Philippines and certainly by a lot of the outside actors, to try to recapture some of that momentum that existed in 2016 and make it clear that if China continues to behave this way, the cost will be its larger global goals of being a leader. That path is a lot narrower and a lot harder to reach than it was 5 years ago.
That is really important to think about, I think, Greg. And just to close us out here, I want to ask you, given the situation that we have now, where essentially it appears that China is doing whatever it wants in the South China Sea, from building up islands from 2013 to 2015 and militarizing those islands, and now you know, increasingly encroaching upon other claimant states' territory with the maritime militia. What are the goals of other claimant states and the United States in the South China Sea? What do we hope to accomplish understanding what is going on at this very moment?
For the U.S. and the outside parties, I think the goals are a little different than they are for the claimants, but they are, the Venn diagram is more aligned than not. So for the U.S. and the outside parties, the goal seems to be to thread the needle between avoiding violence. You know, nobody wants to provoke a war over the South China Sea, while still imposing enough reputational and economic cost on Beijing that China seeks some kind of off-ramp, seeks a compromise with the Southeast Asian parties. That would mean clarifying the Nine Dash Line, giving up the idea of historic rights, or at least clarifying it, you know, into language that the rest of us can live with, giving up on further militarization, agreeing not to, you know, agreeing to permanently forego the use of force, basically coming to an agreement in which China will, of course, be preeminent in the South China Sea, but within a framework that preserves the overall rules of the road when it comes to freedom of the seas and UNCLOS. Because the alternatives to that are either that you accept that the South China Sea is effectively a Chinese lake, and therefore you accept that rules actually don't apply in Asia anymore, that the rules are whatever China says they are, or that you end up in a conflict, which, even if you won, the juice wouldn't be worth the squeeze. So those are the outside parties' goals, you know, avoid conflict while pushing China toward an off-ramp. For the Southeast Asian parties, of course, they would all love that. They also have kind of more immediate nationalist and political goals to uphold their own claims. And for them, the territorial claims are at least as important, in some cases more important, as the maritime claims. So where the U.S. and other parties are neutral, obviously Vietnam, the Philippines, and Malaysia aren't. There's also a huge disconnect among the Southeast Asians over how this is prioritized. So for Vietnam, the South China Sea is a top issue for most of the Vietnamese public and a pretty significant issue for Vietnamese leaders, and arguably the most important issue in Sino-Vietnamese relations these days. There is a line that Vietnam will not cross as far as compromising. For the Philippines, the issue is extremely emotive and occasionally jumps to the top of the policy hierarchy, but has not really stayed there under Duterte. What happens for the next year, whether or not Duterte moves, is an open question. What happens after he leaves office next year is an open question. For Malaysia, this issue is nowhere close to the top of the priorities. And under the current government, there's a very clear effort to keep the South China Sea out of the press and pretend that what's happening isn't happening, which makes concerted action extremely difficult for the Southeast Asian parties.
Well, on that note, Greg, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure hearing from you and gaining from your expertise.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at Hopkins POFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.